everyone, and welcome to the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. We are pleased to have you today, here tonight, and this program, this Good for America, is actually the teacher institute that's running all of this week. We have 15 teachers from across the state of Pennsylvania who are here to develop pilot curriculum about script. This teacher institute actually is being put on by three organizations: the Historical Society of Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania Department of Education, and the Institute for American Arts. And we are very grateful to them for having put together this panel, because we know it's going to be a very stimulating conversation. And without much further ado, I'm going to turn the mic over to David Blankenport, who will be our moderator this evening, as he has been one of our moderators this week. He is the president and founder of the Institute for American Values.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. Thank you, Beth, and the Pennsylvania Antiquarian Society. So here's all the news. Everybody on this side of the room, just don't eat anything more. Have small portions on those little refreshment things, but we need to make a statement against consumerism and so forth. You people over here, have an extra cookie. Do more things, because the economy and the environment and your very soul will be enriched thereby. So, go forward and enjoy things. Now,
too late.
You've made your choices, but maybe this will change some of your minds. Is the sound okay for everybody? Is anybody being bothered by the sound? Okay. Well, thank you all for coming. And an interesting thing happened in the last year, which is that two distinguished history professors from the great neighboring state of New Jersey issued books for our education that weighed in on the financial crisis of today. What is the nature of that crisis? What are the historical roots of the crisis? And how can we best think about getting out of the crisis? And we're very lucky because both of these professors are here with us tonight. And Professor James Livingston, Jim Livingston, professor at Rutgers, has written this book called Against Thrift: Why Consumer Culture is Good for the Economy, the Environment, and Your Soul. And that would be the summary. Now, and because of the glitch in communications with our, through nobody, well, no one in this room, we don't have books for you to buy and have been signed, but we want everybody to buy the book anyway and can go to me. Where's that line? You're back here. You can arrange to get you copies of this book in the most convenient possible way. Okay. The other history professor from New Jersey is Sheldon Gehr, a professor of history at Princeton University. He wrote this book, Beyond Our Means: Why America Spends While the World Saves. Now, the interesting thing about these two men and these two books is that they take different points of view. I don't know if they're diametrically opposite on every question, but let's just say they have a fundamentally different way of understanding and diagnosing the current crisis, and that's what's going to make tonight's conversation very, very interesting. So, I'm going to talk to these guys for a little bit, and then we're going to open it up for questions and answers, and that's how we go. Now, I want to start with you, Jim Livingston, and just ask you briefly, what were the concerns or questions that you had that caused you to want to write the book?
Thank you, Scott. The first thing that happened was, I wrote a book about the Federal Reserve a long time ago, came out in 1986, and it's still in print. And every time some downturn in the economy occurs, people buy it. It sells like 40 copies. So when the crisis occurred, 2008, I hadn't been doing economic history or economic theory for a long time. That's where I started, but I'm now much more of an intellectual historian. I got a bunch of emails from people, strangers, and also from friends saying, okay, you're the guy who wrote the book on Fed. It's time that you stepped up, as we like to say in the world sports, and explain this. What in the hell happened? So, I have this little blog. I wrote a two-part piece at the blog on this, and then I sent it to a couple of friends. I ended up taking them viral, just to give you an example. They appeared in History News Network, but it was The Atlantic, American Prospect, The Republic. They were excerpted. And that caused an agent to get in touch with me to say, why don't you write a book? And my immediate response was, well, I'll do that anymore. I'll do economic history. But I thought, well, this is an opportunity because, as we all know, even The Economist, the syllabus for the CEO set, says we need a paradigm shift. We need a change of mindset. Because The Economist blew it on the way down, and The Economists are still blowing it on the way up. If you want to call off. Thank you.
So basically, the internet, the blog, led to inquiries.
Right.
And you decided to write the book.
Yeah.
And what year was this?
2008, when the media got in touch with me. I wrote the proposal over 2009. I started writing it in the book in late 2009. It was done by February 2010.
Okay.
But here's, I add one more thing. I've been arguing for a long time. I published a book in 1994, which nobody's read. It's called Pragmatism and the Political Economy of Cultural Revolution, in which I use a whole chapter to argue that the Great Depression was caused by a lack of consumption, oversaving. And so I developed that argument in the new book to explain the Great Recession. And I made an explicit comparison between the Great Depression and the Great Recession.
Shell, the same for you. Question, concern in your mind that caused you to want to write the book?
Is the mic on? Okay. Well, I come at this from a very different perspective than Jim Livingston, because I'm not a historian of the United States. I'm actually a historian of Japan. That's what I've done most of my career. And I originally was going to write a book about Japan exclusively, about why the Japanese, and this was a long time ago, seemed to save so much money. So it was an idea that I first started thinking about in the 1990s, and it wasn't clear that Japan was going to be in 20 years of economic stagnation, nor was it clear that the Japanese would actually stop saving money. So today the Japanese savings rate is actually below the U.S. savings rate. So you could say I diversified my portfolio. and it wasn't just that. But I became interested in a type of history that's now becoming quite popular called transnational or global history. And I became aware that the Japanese were not freaks in being very pro-savings from about the late 19th century to the late 20th century. That, in fact, many of the institutions that the Japanese had used to promote saving very aggressively, things like school savings programs, and particularly the very famous, infamous Japanese postal savings system, which is today actually the world's largest bank, it's so large, that these things were not unique to Japan at all. Any of you who are Europeans in the audience know this, that many of the savings institutions and even the idea of savings campaigns were modeled after things that the Japanese in part saw happening in Europe. So then I realized I had a European and a Japanese story, and that was very interesting. Basically, the history of modern saving. So we think of saving and thrift as something that's kind of old-fashioned and that got displaced by consumer culture. But in a sense, just as consumer cultures were developing in the 1800s, so were modern cultures of people, ordinary people, saving in the bank. So that was going to be my book, Japan and Europe. And then I finally, in sync with Jim Livingston, I was going to do a little bit on the U.S., but I really wasn't quite sure what to do about it. And then 2008 happened, and all of a sudden it wrote the rest of the book, because Of course, economists and others had told me all along the way that the Japanese were idiots for saving, that the Americans had actually figured out that rather than having small savings accounts, you could invest in assets like land and in the stock market, and you would get these incredible rates of return, and we had a very efficient credit system, and everything was going to be fine. And then 2008 happened, and I realized that housing, as well as consumer credit, was a big part of this history and what made Americans quite different from both the Japanese and the Europeans. So that's basically how my book came together.
Great. And Beyond Our Means was published in 2011?
Yes. Yeah, right at, I think it was probably about the same time as Jim's book, November.
Yeah.
Okay. Just in time for Christmas shopping.
Just in time. And you can still, well, no. Over consumption should be books being taught, except for yours. Now, four quick questions for you before we go into a little more. I want to have each of you be able to just kind of make your main argument. But first, I want to just put yes or no. This is a thought experiment.
Yes or no?
Yes or no. You don't have to, however you say it, I don't know. You know, yes, no, or I don't know. Okay, here's the premise. You are an adult American. You were living in the early 21st century.
That's true, so far.
What's likely to be the best choice for you personally? More spending or more saving?
More saving.
You?
Personally?
Yes.
Well, I have been a saver, and it's...
Yes, spending, saving, or I don't know?
Probably a balance between the
What's likely to be what's likely to be the best choice for society overall? More spending or more saving?
In the short term, more spending because the succession doesn't end without that. But I would also go on to say absolutely more spending for long-term balanced growth.
This one's complicated. In principle, I agree with Jim that we need more consumer spending now. That clearly would help jumpstart the economy. The problem is we've so screwed up our household finances by encouraging over the last 15 years people to spend, more than spend, to borrow, that they are now in a rut.
So,
okay.
As regards your own personal habits, what's likely to be more rewarding, consuming or producing?
Consuming.
I like my work.
What am I supposed to say?
I get a lot of joy out of my work. I'm not sure I'm a teacher. I'm not sure if I'm producing.
Tim said producing. As regards to happiness of society overall, what's likely to be more rewarding? More consuming in society or more producing in society?
I'd say less producing, for sure, and more consuming. Again, consumer culture needs to be more spending things, spending money on things.
Okay. So we'll get to that. Same for you. Happiness overall. What's the strategy, more consuming or more producing?
People actually get a lot out of work when their work is rewarding. And I agree with Jim, having read his book, that more and more work is not so rewarding in this country. I think we need to make work more rewarding because I think people actually would enjoy that.
Now, what I want to do now is have each of you, play one more one of these little short things, and then I want each of you to have a chance to kind of just, without me interrupting, lay out your argument. But Shell, before Jim does that, do you feel comfortable in one or two sentences saying what you believe is the thesis of Jim's book?
I don't feel comfortable.
Yeah. So that would be a no. I wouldn't feel comfortable, but I'll do it.
Okay.
I'll do it.
Give it a shot. One or two sentences.
Okay, this is important.
What you think his main, if you want to say his main argument, what you take to be his main point.
I think his main point is one that I tend to agree with, that there has been a radical shift away from labor, in other words, ordinary working people, toward capital. This is the income inequality that we talk about today, and it's a huge problem. I think his main argument is we need to shift that balance more back to the producers. Now, the second part of his argument is against thrift. I think that's somewhat unrelated, although he obviously thinks it is related.
Okay, so take 5 minutes and just give us your a little more extended version of your main argument.
But if I may, I'll try to be right on what Michelle just said. Try to suture the two parts of the argument. The problem of the book is an economic history. It's an explanation of the Great Recession in terms of the Great Depression. The argument there is very, very straightforward, and that is this. Economic growth does not require saving or net private investment, and hasn't since 1990. What follows from that, is that if you cut taxes on businesses, if you give more incentives to corporations, all you're doing is accumulating surplus capital. That surplus capital, because it does not have to be reinvested in goods production, because it does not have to be reinvested, it streams into speculative channels, like the housing bubble, or since 1983, any bubble that's available. No, I'm serious. I mean, you know, since 1983, since the labor tax cuts, we have had a boom bust cycle, which can be easily solved by redistributing any income away from capital, towards labor. That is to say, in my terms, away from saving towards consumption. All right. So it seems that I've identified the economic problem, I've also identified a fairly simple solution. We don't make it simple because we know the politics right now are stacked against us. Part two, though, this is a problem that I've been trying to work out for 20 years. And that is, how does one come to the defense of consumer culture? How does one, in effect, defend what we all think of as Edens? You know, how do you go about that? That's what part two of the book is about. I'm not defending Edens in mind. I'm trying to say that consumer culture is making more complicated than simply running on goods. It's about what you do after work. It's about what you do after hours. It's about the moments, the time you spend with your friends, with your family, treating them as ends in themselves rather than means to the end of your career. I'll leave it at that. Now, I guess the big problem for me is this. Thrift is an attribute of a character type that emerged in the 16th century during the Reformation. And it is still with us. When markets came to define society, when markets became the means to price and convey property, but at the same moment, when property became the material foundation of the genuine self, of the self-mastering personality, when those two things happened, commerce became both the condition of your genuine selfhood, but also the threat to your character. You had to start saving for a rainy day. You had to have a hedge against the market's vicissitudes, because the market is unpredictable. And always will be. All right. Now, Max Weber did a very close study of this personality type, this character type. He called it the ascetic personality. So the same thing. He called it the anal compulsive or the anal erotic personality. And both of them were writing, remember, in the early 20th century. And at that moment, both of them were noticing that alternatives to this character type were emerging. And those character types have continued since the 20th century to proliferate. So the question for us is not whether these alternatives are emerging. The question is, what is the point of maintaining this character type? Which is, in David's terms and Shell's terms, what is the point of thrift? What are the purposes of thrift? This character type treats thrift as almost an end in itself. Why? What are the purposes of trade? As far as I can tell, the purposes are economic growth. Well, I've already explained to you, saving is bad for growth. Cycles up in social mobility. We used to save, right, because we were wage earners and we wanted to have our own businesses be actually entrepreneurs unto ourselves. That's not how we deal with social mobility anymore. So let's think of that one too. Geriatric grace or safety. Save for a rainy day. Why? How do you do that? Two ways. You save for a down payment on a house. Why do you do that? Well, our houses are okay. They're kind of nice, right? But mainly, what you want to do is form a family. And you want to be able to pass on that investment to your own kids. You want to be able to help them out when it's time enough to start a family. All right. That purpose is pretty clearly over. Don't think that the housing market is coming back. Not in your lifetime. Average age here, I think, is about 49. Not in your lifetime. Is it not your children? Not their lifetime? Never. The thing is never coming back. It's not worth it. It's too dangerous. So don't talk to me about geriatric safety by investing in housing. What's the other reason? Retirement. Now, why would you save for retirement? Seems to me you're a moron if that's what you think. All right? Let me put it this way. You have to save 20 times your income when you retire to maintain your standard of living. That means you have to save 5% of your income over 40 years or 15% over 20 years. Anybody doing that? I don't think. Thank you. Two people. Right. Okay. It's a fool's errand. I lost 35% of my retirement account in 6 months. So how are most of you, right? We're putting money in the hands of money managers and bankers who are screwing us. Why don't we socialize, collectivize this problem of retirement, of maintaining people's incomes when their jobs are over or when they can't work? It's insane for us to think about this in individualistic terms. It's a social problem. Let's socialize the solution. All right. What's left then? Geriatric safety, social welfare, economic growth, out the window. What's left? The only reason we believe in church is because we believe that it forms, it makes our character. Saving for a rainy day is a way of withholding not just emotion, but income from the present. Why do we do it? What is the point? Isn't it time that we actually examine the character type that is invested in saving, in withholding from the present, in the name of a future that can't, you know? Isn't it time we got over that? Isn't it time we ask, like Vader did? Like Freud did, is this really worth it? Are we just killing ourselves? Haven't we actually reached the point that Herbert Marcuse predicted in the 1950s and 60s when we suffer from surplus repression? We're killing ourselves. For what? Why? Why are we doing this? Why are we withholding all of these resources, our emotions, and our incomes from the present? There's no reason to do it. Unless, of course, you believe that adulthood can only be achieved by this application of surplus pressure.
Well, keep it on time. And in 1 to 2 sentences, if you wish, tell me what you think is the main thesis of Shell's book.
I'm embarrassed to say that I have not read it. So I can't. Sorry.
All right. Shell.
Do you want me to make
up? Well, no.
Actually, you know what? I think I can. The economies that grow at rates that facilitate social mobility and equal opportunity, or opportunity that approximates equality, those economies are the ones that save more than they consume. So, for example, the Chinese economy right now, between 40% and 50% of the resources and the income available is invested in saved as opposed to consumed. And that is the path to a future in which growth can be balanced against the excesses of consumer culture as in the United States.
You're running out of sentences.
Oh, all right. That in the system has been subverted.
Okay. Only
him.
Okay.
Have you read your...
I have.
All right, now take the similar language and just tell us your main argument.
Okay, Jim stated one of several of the arguments, but the main argument is, the reason I was a little frustrated by David's questions originally about savings versus consumption, choose one. This is not actually the way that the real world works. People both save and consume. Anybody who saves everything is going to starve to death. Everyone who consumes everything is actually going to look like an American. and they're going to be in a lot of trouble, as a lot of Americans have been after 2008, when the housing bubble collapsed and they found that they had negative equity and they had no liquid saving. And that is the state we're at in America today. Some 43%, even half of the population, has little or no liquid saving, and they don't have much more in retirement saving. So this is a problem. In other words, how to restore the balance. So the book is about how it's a global study, as I said, about the first world, about Europe, the United States, and East Asia, particularly Japan, but China is in there as well. And it's about, it's not simply an advocacy book. It's an attempt to explain why a lot of other peoples in the first world have focused so much more on saving, and Americans have focused much more on spending and credit. So, it's a historical analysis in that sense. Now, getting back to some of Jim's points, though, or at least his interpretation of the book, is saving. I use the word thrift when I'm studying how people use it historically, but I'm not a big advocate of thrift as a character builder. I'm an advocate of saving as one part of our economic behavior that is balanced against borrowing and spending. So when you put it in those terms, I guess what is saving good for? Instead of maybe David's question, what is thrift good for? Well, a moderate amount of saving can be very, very useful. First of all, I would reject his statement that economies can grow without savings. But we do happen to have had growth. It just doesn't have to come from our savings. It happens to come from Chinese and Japanese saving and other people. So we have to factor that one in. Secondly, we do have to be global. Clearly, a number of economies in Europe and Japan came back after the devastation of World War II, largely based on a lot of saving, even austerity, a dirty word in America, but one that's coming back to some extent in Europe. But a lot of saving in places like West Germany, Japan, France, etc. So we need to keep that in mind. We also need to think at the household level, what happens when you don't have any saving? You are in a lot of trouble, because Jim has a wonderful utopian prescription that we should socialize consumption and investment. That is called taxation. I'm a big believer in it. I think he and I politically are actually quite close together. But we're not there yet. To prescribe to the American people that go on a spending binge, it's going to be life-affirming, and everything's going to turn out, is not true. Because we have a pretty lousy welfare state in this country in safety nets compared to Europeans. So, I don't want to be harsh, but as I read this book, I knew his politics and they were progressive, but I thought, could he be working for J.P. Morgan? Because that's exactly what they want us to do, to spend and borrow in a nice predatory way, and they don't care what happens to society. I'm sure Jim does, but sometimes when you read the book, I'm not totally sure. Now, one last comment about his remarks, if I may. It's the word saving economically has a number of variations. He is talking, when he talks about surplus capital, he's largely talking about corporate saving, which is, as I agree with him, is a problem in this country. There's too much corporate saving, there's too much wealth to float to corporations.
Focusing really on household.
What's that?
You're talking about personal household.
Well, and then there is household saving, which I think is quite different. We probably need less corporate saving. We need more household saving so that people can have independence and invest in their futures, their education, etc. But there's the third type of saving, and that's government saving. And that's taxation, which you want, which I want. But so we need to understand that, as is consumption is a very tricky term. Because what Americans have tended to do is engage in privatized saving, particularly after World War II. You buy your own car. You finance your own education. You even finance a lot of your own health expenses. Europeans, and to some extent Japanese, tend to socialize their consumption. You have wonderful public transportation systems, fairly low-cost education, sometimes even free education, and every first world country in this world has national health insurance. So, Jim talks in his book about how consumption is wonderful because it's unforced sacrifice. Anybody who has to spend on cars and car repairs when you're poor because you don't have a public transportation system, anybody who has to spend tens of thousands of dollars on student loans, this is not happy consumption or health care. So we need to put all these things in context, I think, and not just tell people to go on and spend individually.
May I say, I agree with everything Sheldon said, including whether utopian fissures in my book.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you guys, they always say it's hard to achieve disagreement, you know? In other words, it's easy to debate a straw person, it's easy to, try to achieve disagreement in a good way. What do you think? Achieving disagreement also involves and requires what you two are doing, which is also identifying areas of agreement. But help us here. Take a few minutes, just the two of you, back and forth. I don't want to be involved that much. Try to figure out what is the main point, main one or two points of disagreement between the two of you.
It could be, I'm not sure. It could be that I don't think that most of the programmatic statements or versions that are in the book are that utopian. Here's an example. Sheldon talked about socializing savings, that Japan and other countries have been able to do this. And a lot of analysts don't find savings, right? Yeah, household. Corporate savings, that's is withheld from circulation as wages. Right? So that's profit savings and stuff like that. So corporate savings, household savings, and there is government savings. Most, by the way, of the investment component in the national income and product accounts, most of the so-called investment is government spending on one hand and consumer spending on the other for housing. So very much. I'll say that investment is not the driver of growth. All right, now, how do we go about socializing savings? It seems like a huge task, and it seems, especially in this political economy, to be something almost utopian. Except, we've already done it. We have already socialized savings. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation is subsidized by our taxes. We stand as the guarantors of the bank deposits that we make in commercial banks, all right? The bankers don't. If that is true, and of course it is, I mean, it's incontrovertible, there is no rationale, there's no rational grounds in which to defend the private allocation of those deposits by bankers. We've already socialized this. We've already socialized that risk. We've already also socialized the banks, and the biggest ones as well, with that bailout that we accomplished in 2009 and 2010. We already socialized these risks. There is no reason for us not to take responsibility for what we already own.
For individuals, what you're proposing is that what is now resides with the responsibility of the individual to save for a rainy day, to open up an account and regularly put money into what you want to do is, through the system of taxation, have the government save for everyone. Mm-hmm. And therefore alleviating, transferring the activity from the private to the public domain.
Not entirely. Here's where I think where Saul's a good point. And that is, it's not an either or. You know, I'm not saying you shouldn't be saving. Of course you'd be saving. You know, save all you want. So make your life.
Someone has to do the saving, right? I mean,
somebody doesn't have to do the saving. Because, look, if you save as an individual, it's not going to help you in your retirement. It's not going to help you buy that house, or it's not going to help you maintain the value of that house. So, no.
If I save all my life and build up my retirement funds and so forth, mm-hmm. and then I retire, mm-hmm. that money won't help me.
Well, if you're like me, you lost almost 40% of it 2 years ago. So, yeah, where you once thought, I've got less than $600,000 in my retirement account. Okay, it could have been, had there been no Great Recession, something near $900,000. I need $2 million when I retire to maintain the standard of living at the moment of my retirement.
If it's saying that an economic crisis has caused you potentially not to have enough money to retire is one thing. But saying that people needn't bother to save for their retirement because it's pointless is another thing. Wouldn't you agree?
It sure is. And what I'm saying is, let's not keep putting money in the hands of the bankers. Let's not do that. Or who's in the hands of bankers and supervisors?
So you're saying that the area of disagreement that you pointed to is that you're saying that the prescriptive elements of the money that we can collectivize a range of activities that have been left to private actors heretofore, and in your view, unsuccessfully and unfairly and unevenly achieved, that this is not this utopian pie in the sky idea, but it's actually their precedents in the society now that say that no, a rational society can do this because there are elements of it that are already being done. Okay. What you can respond to that if you want, but I'm also just interested in your view of where you think the main point of disagreement between the two of you is.
Well, first I would say Jim is a very lucky guy to have $600,000. Because I think he should be aware of what an ordinary American has in their retirement saving. The latest surveys by Progressive Organization has found that 3/4 of Americans nearing retirement, that is between 50 and 64 years of age, 3/4 of those have an average retirement saving, average, not median, average, of only $30,000. But in fact, if you take the median, 50% and below, their median retirement saving is zero. Okay, so we have to understand the sort of trouble that people have. Now, the idea that people can retire only on government saving has actually not been tried out in many places. Our Social Security system was designed to be a three-legged system, as I think you know. Social Security plus your private saving plus your what used to be known as a pension. Now, of course, we don't have any traditional pensions anymore, so it's supposed to be your 401k. Well, the problem is that most Americans don't have two of the legs anymore. So this is a huge problem. Now, another thing to note is when I said most other places have not actually tried the system of the government entirely in charge of saving, it is very interesting. I think Americans tend to miss this, partly because maybe they don't travel enough. But if they did, they would notice that in Europe, that the super welfare states also have super savings rates. The Germans, the Austrians, the Belgians, even the Swedes, with their enormous welfare state, have household savings rates now about 12 or 13%. Almost most of the ones I mentioned are over 10%. So it actually has been a part of the welfare states in these places that, one, the government stands by you as the ultimate resort, something I tend to agree with politically, but two, you are expected and enabled to have your own savings, in part, two reasons. One, because the government, as I said, has socialized consumption, great transportation systems, low-cost education, low-cost healthcare. But the other thing is that in all these places, governments have actually done a lot, and this goes back 200 years, they have done a lot institutionally to enable people to privately save. Whereas in our country, we had a good period right around World War II and the immediate post-war period, savings and loans, U.S. savings bonds, made it very easy for people to say, we don't do that anymore. We have a voluntary retirement savings system, which is a mess, doesn't cover half of the people, and the other half don't actually put in much. We no longer have savings and loans. We don't have a lot of accessible banks for lower-income people in urban areas. Our banks gouge them, I'm sure you would agree with that. So the Europeans in having interventionist welfare states, they don't just say the government's going to do everything, they're also going to enable the second leg or the third leg of the stool. We do a terrible job of that. So I think, I mean, I don't want to sound harsh, but I think we have a rather naive idea of the relationship of states to private savings.
What's interesting about what Shell says to me is that notice that there's no antithesis between the welfare state on one hand and very healthy, very robust private savings on the other. That should tell us something about how we can impact socialized savings, socialized banking system, without the danger of threatening the self-made man, the entrepreneur. Questions for me then, prompted by Shell's remarks. Why don't we encourage savings? That is to say, what are the policies that are in place that discourage saving, and why is that? As far as I can tell, it's because policymakers understand that it's consumer spending that drives growth, not saving, whether private household savings or corporate profits. These are simply unnecessary, and so there is no point in encouraging. This is what policymakers understand. Whether they say so or not, this is a different matter. So that's why we don't encourage savings. Now, we could, it seems to me, but on the other hand, what happened to the savings and loans? Back in the day, 1979?
We deregulated them.
Yeah. So
that was the problem.
Yeah, we have to reconstruct that system, it seems to me, from the bottom up for anybody to trust
it. My question is, if the concept is that we don't, spending is really what matters, and saving is not important, and that running up, going into debt is not such a big thing to worry about, and that individual acts of self-sacrifice to save for a rainy day and so forth is not really part of the plan for progress. This seems to me, and the policymakers encourage all this by saying, go out and patriotically spend your money because that will keep the economy going. This seems like a very accurate description of the dominant mainstream worldview of the last 20 years or more. How's that working for us?
This is a question for me.
Well, either of you. My argument would be that that view has been shown to have failed. It's a failed view.
I think, I think that's a naive explanation for the crisis. We heard it from both left and right, from David Brooks on the right, from David Lynn on the left, sometimes even Paul Krugman was down in the same room. The idea that the Great Recession was caused by consumer excess, I think, is the unsafe premise of what you said. This policy, or this attitude, or this demeanor has failed us, both economically and morally on the other. I would, and the part one of the book is a model payment, not just.
Saying Shell says that.
No,
I'm just speaking for myself.
Okay. I think that's wrong. I think on empirical grounds, consumer excess had very little to do with it. I would say just, you could really run up there and say, had nothing to do with the causes of the Great Recession. When we denounce consumers for borrowing when they shouldn't have, and buying all this junk shipped from China, we're missing absolutely what really mattered. So
I was really just saying that when you have half the country that doesn't have two nickels to rub together in their savings and are in pretty desperate straits, I was really pointing out that the suffering that people have experienced by being told that they should spend and don't worry about saving. So, I interrupted probably wrongly. I'm not asking you to defend what I just said. Say whatever it is you want to say.
Well, okay, a little self-promotional, but my book is a rather varied and complicated historical analysis of how we got to the point we are in today, and there's no one word. But I will agree with you that I'm not targeting consumer excess. That's the effect, not the cause. So in my book, just in a nutshell, I start with the 19th century, the 1800s, and I speak about how institutionally America is considerably different than the institutional promotion of saving that you see pursued by the European countries and Japan. The U.S. has some savings banks. They have some building and loan associations that turn into SNLs. But they're very unevenly spread, and in large parts of the country, as late as 1910, Americans had no access, Americans of modest means, had no access to a savings institution, which makes it very hard to save. I mean, if you're putting under the mattress, that has been shown not to be a very effective way of encouraging saving. So that was one problem. The Americans began to converge to, I think, the institutional promotion of saving in World War II with the savings bond program and also with FDIC, which in a sense really kicks in after World War II and makes the banks safe, which American banks have not been before. And of course, that encourages small savers to know that your deposits are safe. So there's kind of a golden age of institutional promotion of saving. Well, the U.S. looks a lot like everybody else from the 1940s through about the 1960s or so. The big turning point is the 1980s and the 1990s, and that's when we have two things happening. One, we have the decline of this post-war system that made it easy for small savers to save. U.S. savings bonds began disappearing. The SNLs really disappeared because of deregulation. But the other thing that's happening is 1980s financial deregulation, which in my book is maybe the worst thing that's ever happened to us, that by unleashing the financial industry with almost no regulation whatsoever, they increasingly engaged in very predatory lending practices. From the credit card industry, which became deregulated and could charge any interest rates and engaged in these untransparent 30-page contracts designed deliberately to ensnare people in debt because that's where the profits came, to the home equity loan, which didn't really even exist before the mid-1980s, but was enabled by a tax reform law, and again, nobody really watching in Washington, the sort of predatory lending, the subprime mortgage, et cetera, et cetera. Now the student loan problem, which may be the biggest crisis of all. These were the results of deregulation, and they didn't happen in a lot of other places. They did tend to happen in the English-speaking countries. They didn't happen in continental Europe. They didn't happen in Japan. They have some of their own problems, but they didn't have this predatory lending wave that resulted. I mean, we still have to remember the 2008 crisis. You know, we think it's all the Europeans' fault today, but we were the trigger. We were the trigger of the fact that the bubble burst, and it was a housing bubble, and it was enabled by very predatory practices by the financial industry. So that's the argument of my book. Maybe we're not so far apart.
No, I don't think we are. But I'd love to develop that some point of disagreement here. Maybe here's a way to do it. It seems to me, let me start with you here. I couldn't agree more with Shell and thinking that the re-regulation of the financial industry, and I don't mean the reinstatement of Glass-Steagall, I think that's
okay, fine.
But it's not necessarily hard. The re-regulation of the financial industry could work, but it seems to me the re-regulation that we would have to establish amounts to is the equivalent of the socialization of bank assets and the allocation both of risk and reward. So in that sense, I think we're close. On the one hand, I think Sheldon would say, well, that sounds utopian, it's a TV. It's not really even a choice. It's something that we have to do. We have to take responsibility for this business. All right. The other point that he made that I think is really interesting, and here's where we may depart from each other, is that the golden age of saving is the moment between the 1940s and approximately the 1960s in this country. I did it I'm trying to get it more precisely. It lasts from 1933 to 1972, this golden age, for a couple of reasons. And not just because of regulation, but also because the New Deal worked, and worked after the 1930s into the 40s, 50s, 60s. Now, how did it work? Believe it or not, between 1933 and 1937, the fastest growth rates of the 20th century happened, 1933 to 1937. Why? It wasn't a financial fix. The banks did absolutely nothing between 1933 and 1937. If you look at the reports of the Comptroller of the Currency, you will find that between 1933 and 1937, the member banks of the Federal Reserve System increased their deposits with the Fed, that is to say, parking their reserves at the Fed, by 150%, and they increased their purchases of government securities over 100%. Meanwhile, 1933-1937, they increased their loans and discounts to private business by 8%. They didn't really have that, governments. There was a huge recovery. Again, fastest annual growth rates in the 20th century, 33 to 37. Think of all the things up, of course, because those are the ones that have the budget. The point is, how do you explain that? You explain it this way. Net contributions to consumer spending out of federal deficits. The use of taxes, the use of government savings, if you will, to promote consumption. That's how those amazing growth rates took place, 33 to 37. And that's how, between 33 and 37, not only consumption drove growth, but, as Sheldon pointed out, and I think you heard about this, again, savings too. It's the golden age of both savings and consumption. Why? Because the welfare state, as you like to either call it or criticize it, mattered. It worked. Question?
You said, 33-37
high interest rate. Yeah. The banks had more money to lend out, mm-hmm. and they were lending out more money.
You don't get
that
anything
to
do with just inflation, or just the fact that the Fed just prints money in the book
that's
disproving positive?
No.
Then nothing to do with that.
I don't think so. We love the gold standard. That's for sure. And
Christine
Lohmer.
That's what gets you all inflation. That gets you all inflation. The fact that you can get on gold, you have nothing to hold you to hard money. You just print your way out of everything. And you make the dollar worth it.
No, I don't think so. No, I think Christina Lohmer, of all people, agrees with you. She was Obama's first choice for the Council of Advisors. She wrote a piece one time ago where she said that if the New Deal couldn't explain the growth rates of 33-37, she described it to meeting the gold standard and inflation. So you might be arguing for inflation. You might be saying that inflation, 33-37, was caused by
inflation. It helped produce. Okay,
I'm gonna bring the mic up here.
That was my phone.
So let's do this. Let's So let's do some, let's switch over. I'm going to ask a question. What I want to ask you to do is, so we can get your picture in the shot, just come up right over here. I'm going to hold the mic and ask your question, and it can be for either or both, and you will come there. Come right up here. You're going to follow the mic.
Thank you. A couple of points. I'm an economist. And I heard no mention of Keynes. I'm a little disappointed.
Why? Because
Keynes.
Oh.
And quite simply, there has to be someone lacking up savings at a given time and spending. And I just like your comment on that point. The second point is my study of the economics of consumers. Lack of savings is often regretted by those who do not save. It's what I call preference pollution in my work. So that people wish they had desires to save on. Any comment you might have on that? You may claim, I'll just say quickly, that that's a leftover from a puritanical tradition of what have you, but I'd like
to. I'd love to say I think Keynes is absolutely central here. I think you're absolutely right. But my hero, Keynes, my hero is the guy who wrote The Treatise on Money. Because if you look at Volume 2, as you know, that thing is all he doesn't really know what he's doing. He's writing between 1929 and 1930, comes out in 1930. But if you look carefully at the empirical stuff, in Volume 2, late in the book, pages 194, you'll find that what he's saying is that something bizarre and absolutely novel has happened in the United States of America. There has been extraordinary growth, but it has nothing to do with the profit levels of the moment. These profits have been piled up, but what has happened is that technical innovation has become so extraordinary that all it takes is the use of depreciation funds of companies to improve the productivity and output of their capital stock. Now, that seems to me is the pivot on which you begin to rethink the meaning of saving and the meaning of investing. He's already, in 1930, with the Treatise on Money, Volume 2, saying, we can have growth. Look at the United States. This extraordinary growth of the 1920s didn't require investment. That's the key. Now, you could say, the general theory is another matter, but that's what he's speaking to economists. The Treatise on Money is talking to himself. He's trying to explain a whole lot of things to himself. So it's a
just anything about Keynes? Yeah, I do too. We've all talked about it in our books. But, in my book, I talk about Keynes, and then I talk about American Keynesianism. And I think that there has been a much more optimistic spin put on Keynes historically in this country and to the present by Americans, partly because we have a more vibrant, optimistic economy, but partly because of certain thinking that developed in World War II on the part of various American economists associated with the New Deal. And now the original Keynes, of course, we can differ about, it's like the original Marx, and we can do a lot of textual analysis here on which page we find things. But Keynes, at least as I understand him, is talking about countercyclical policies. So, of course, he's doing, a lot of pivotal work at the height of the Depression, and the countercyclical is obviously he wants government stimulation of the economy so that workers will go back to work, so that they will have money to spend, and that consumption eventually will take us out of it. It's countercyclical policy. In my book, I talk about Keynes at the height of World War II as well. In 1940 and 41, when Britain's at war, he actually calls for compulsory savings plans that are more radical than even the thrift nuts at the time are talking about. He wants basically government-directed compulsory saving based on income because, again, he sees the economy as overheating in wartime, the specter of World War I-style inflation, and he wants to restrain that by this active government-directed economizing at the household level. So he is a counter-cyclical man, but the American Keynesians, many of them, not all of them, but a lot of them, in wartime and right after the war, got this idea that there could be this sort of solid state, constant stoking of consumption for high economic growth, not only in busts, but in booms. At the time that there might be inflationary pressures, you still keep stoking consumption. In a sense, we still have that formulation, even among people who would not claim to be Keynesians now. So, everybody wants the Christmas shopping system to save our economy. Republicans want it, Democrats want it. So we're kind of locked into that formulation that I think comes from this historical optimistic American Keynesian. Yes. We could go on and on and talk about the paradox of thrift. I don't know.
want to do that. But I think there's a lot of American misunderstanding about Keynes, and most of the rest of the world does not accept Keynes in terms of constant stimulation the way we do, which is part of the problem we're having with Europeans now.
Right. Sir.
Well, Dr. Gentleman seemed not to have touched on is for whose benefit are we being thrifty or spending? Is it for the individual or for the country? If it's for the individual, the obvious answer is be thrifty. Now, I remember when I was out of work for 18 months, I lived on my savings. I saved 10% of my paycheck every paycheck, and for 18 months, that's what I lived on. There was no country coming to me and saying, Andy, here's some money. We'll help you. So I'd like you both to answer the question. Do you want me to be thrifty for the sake of the country, for the individual, and the same for you?
I want the country to be thrifty for the sake of you.
Pardon?
I want the country to be thrifty for the sake of you, the individual. That's what I mean by saying. We have to socialize savings and socialize our retirement programs.
Right.
You can't do it by yourself.
Yeah.
You have to do something with it.
I think possibly what you're referring to is this concept of what Keynes and others have called the paradox of thrift. The idea is that what can be a good strategy for the individual, saving and deferred gratification and so forth, can at times, said Keynes, be bad for the society as a whole. And can therefore, in the long run, end up making everybody poorer. My own view is that's a false idea. But I don't think that there's anything paradoxical about thrift to begin with. I also think Keynes didn't know what the word meant. And I think he shared that misunderstanding with you, or you shared it with him, because you said the character trait involved was asceticism. That is not what Weber was wrong too. The root of the word thrift is thrive. It means abundance. It means growth. It means productivity. It's not about renunciation. It's not about hating the material world. It's not about an ascetic world. Keynes also used the word hoarding. He said that thrift meant hoarding your money and not spending it. It is not at all what it means. And if people are going to use the word, they must, in my view, have the, they should use it correctly. If they want to say hoarding, they should say hoarding.
Right.
If they want to say asceticism, they should say asceticism. But thrift is a different idea. Thrift is the ethic of wise use. It is not about asceticism, hoarding, and just a little advertisement for the word, but talk a little bit, if you want to, about the paradox of thrift.
Okay. I don't think I'm going to get the applause, but I have yet a third.
I was playing to the gallery. It was an easy cheer.
Let me say the third position on the paradox of thrift.
Yeah.
I think it has been something that was a very small piece of Keynes that American journalists, and to a lesser extent economists, I don't think they trumpeted quite as much. American journalists love this idea. It's very easy to explain to readers that, you know, private saving is going to be ultimately bad for the economy. They love to say that. You'll find it in journalism all over the place.
Yes.
But I think this gentleman brings up an interesting point. Because I think there are two things wrong with this rather vulgar interpretation of the paradox of thrift in this country. One is that Keynes was not really, I mean, he has frivolous moments, but he was not really expecting consumers to just have an on-off switch and save the economy, that poor consumers in the Depression, he was not expecting them to go on spending binges. He knew they couldn't do it.
Before the patriotic
he did that in 1931 when the Depression didn't, it was right before the Austrian bank going down. It looked like things were recovering. You have to contextualize
that. Okay.
But in general, his emphasis was on government stimulation because he thought when you really had a deep, deep recession, Consumers did not have the capacity to bring the economy out. You had to have government stimulation. Then the consumption would follow as the effect, not the cause. So that's one problem. The other problem I have with the way Americans use the paradox of thrift is, and again, I don't think these are real economists who are doing it, but they haven't factored in a lot of the costs of not saving. So they say, well, if you're saving, you're damaging the economy. But as this gentleman points out, it was actually a pretty good thing. You had a small store of savings to get you by because there are enormous social costs with people having no savings. And ultimately, you can't just calculate the, you know, this economic cost and say every dollar you save is taking away from the economy. You have to remember that people who don't have the savings are obviously going to need some sort of public assistance, or we hope. If they have medical emergencies, we as a society will pay for it. And if they have zilch for retirement, we are going to have to pay for it in a way that we haven't even imagined today. We're going to have to really increase Social Security. Americans aren't going to like that. But that's what's going to have to happen. So there are enormous social costs. So I really reject this simplistic paradox of thrifting. And one other thing I should say, economically we have shown in the last few years that there's an economic effect to people having no savings and having excessive borrowing, which is our households cannot jumpstart the economy now because they have been so impoverished by credit. I mean, excessive credit. I think some credit is a great thing, but excessive credit. So there are both economic and social costs that really haven't been factored in by the simplistic journalistic idea.
You're saying that the idea of consumer spending as stimulus now doesn't work because too many people are just tapped out.
Yeah. Yeah, and the people who have the money are the affluent because of the gross inequality that we've come up with. And the affluent can only spend so much. I mean, we know that. You actually have to have a broad-based economy. Somebody disagrees?
More yachts.
More yachts, yeah. Well, you know, the affluent have actually pulled in. So, I mean, if I could make one other comment. You know, there was a lot of hoopla about how Americans were becoming thrifty again because our household savings rate at one point went up to about 5.5%. Now it's actually a little bit below 4%. Not great. But there was a lot of hoopla. Most of that aggregate statistic was the affluent pulling back because they had the capacity to pull back. I mean, it's kind of some of the things you talked about. But if you look at the household level for ordinary middle and lower income households, they were not able to save more. So the savings, this new thrift everybody talked about, that was just the affluent for the most part.
If I may follow up on the sheriff's, it seems to me that we have to talk about the social cost of savings, as well as the social cost of no savings. I think you're absolutely right. Take very, very seriously social costs and saving. If you have nothing to go on for those 18 months, you're going to be relying on gold. But here's the problem, this to me, with the idea of thrift, no matter how you want to define it, it seems to me the central pillar of your own idea about thrift is what is it? Industry, frugality, and I forget the third.
Stewardship.
Okay, stewardship. But industry, the translation you give in this book, which is a pretty wonderful book, I'll say, is hard work. Now, let's grant you that premise. Let's say that thrift involves hard work and it involves frugality. Oh. Then the question becomes, is there enough work to go around? Is there enough meaningful work to go around? It seems to me that the obvious answer to that question is no. 20% of household incomes in this country right now come from transfer payments. That is to say, from public spending. 20%. One out of every $5 that goes into households right now comes from public sources, that is to say, taxes and transfer payments. Okay? Why? Is it because people don't want work? Or is it because there's not enough jobs? Is it because the jobs have been outsourced? What? Look, if we're going to talk about thrift as being driven by, or animated by, or predicated on hard work, then we're going to have to redefine work. And we're also going to have to redefine the relationship between the production of value through work on one hand, and the receipt of income for work on the other. Because there's not enough work to go around. There's not enough work to go around. Then one of the pillars of thrift in Cincinnati passes away. And I use that.
The concept of work is one of the pillars of self-sufficiency is no longer present because we have a 9-point-something% unemployment.
That's charming?
No. It has nothing to do with the unemployment except that we cannot create jobs enough through the means that we take for granted. In other words, we think that the so-called job creators are the people in the private sector who save their money, invest in businesses, especially those small businesses. I'll never understand that part. But that's so we worship at the shrine of these so-called job creators. They cannot, and they do not, create enough jobs for the mere growth of the population. Even if they cut off all immigration, there's not enough room to go around. So what happens then to that point of view?
I think I heard you say that because there is unemployment that is higher than you want it to be, therefore we can't talk about the value of thrift.
No, that's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is that private investment will not create enough jobs.
For whatever reason, there isn't enough jobs.
Right, but let's just extract from the question of unemployment. What we have is a system where private investment cannot create enough work. We have a system in which 1/5, 20% of all household income comes from public spending, comes from sources we call taxes. That means to me something very, very plain. We need to think about how to redefine work, and we need to think about how to redefine the relationship between the income you receive and the work that you do. Okay? You create value through your work. Some of us do, anyway. I'm not sure because he just pushes paper around. somebody actually produces things, you know, like value. That's good. I'm glad for you. But most of us don't. So, look at Wall Street. What do the traders and CEOs and the brokers and the morons do? Well, they wreck the economy. They screwed it up. We know, right? Is there some intelligible relationship between their effort and their reward? I think not. So that's something that we need to think about. What is the proper or transparent or intelligible relationship between effort and reward? Work and income. It sure as hell not transparent or intelligible if you look at what these guys are running on Wall Street. They're not doing a damn thing as far as I can tell, they're making a lot more money than anybody in the
street. I agree with you, but there's a lot of problems in the products that they make and so forth.
Yes.
I'm not too sure of many things in life, but on the value, on the relationship, on the value of the work ethic as an engine of creativity, personal fulfillment, and social well-being, I just have to say it's not one of those things I feel I need to do for me. I'm just really confident. I mean, there's so many things I'm not confident about, but I'm confident.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong, but I have a high confidence level in a society that you want a society where people, generally speaking, feel that they should make a contribution with their life and that contribution comes, at least in part, maybe not in the paid labor force, but through an activity, through what was the term that Marx used? I mean, right through acting in the world to be productive. This seems to me to be not negated by the problem of not enough jobs in the year 2012 in the month of August.
2000? Okay. First, I have nothing against productive labor.
Well, that's really big of you.
I also think, unemployed company, can I use the F-word here? One of the slogans that I've promoted for a couple of years is use the upward work. That is to say, enough of it. We can produce more than we can use. Let's stop with this principle of productivity. All right? We can produce way, way more. Our problem is a problem of distribution. Our problem is learning to live with what we have or what we can get. Keynes was really good about this.
There were some big theorists in the 60s that talked a lot about that.
Absolutely. Yep.
Let's see if there's some other. Yes, come on.
So I think you're both prescriptively in the same place, right? In the long run, more regulation to the point of maybe even socialization of some of the savings, maybe banking functions. And the thing that, and I really liked your comment about the increase in the savings rate being driven by wealth, because here's my question in the intro, because I'm so concerned about what we're doing to action. Along the lines of your description, that monetary policy is pushing interest rates and return rates and savings for the middle class and the working class who don't have access to investment in the stock market, et cetera, to almost nothing. My mom is looking at bond return rates, and I'm just worried that there's such a disincentive for saving versus consuming in the short run because it's very hard for the bulk of the wealth in this country to retain any type of imagine of inflation in terms of incentive to save. So I just don't know, you know, where we go from that perspective in about savings. While we await the government second hand as a white knight.
Can I see?
Sure.
Yeah. I'm not sure I believe in the socialization of saving per se. I was talking about the socialization of consumption, and of course I wasn't talking about the total socialization. I just said I think we need public transportation, national health care, and affordable education, which are things that are not unattainable, and we used to attain them. And other, I mean, every time I travel abroad, I go between Japan and Europe, and I call it the country of not America, because they have fast, attractive trains, national health care, all these things that we say are impossible to do in America. Okay, so on the interest rates, I mean, you're right. I mean, it's very discouraging to have low interest rates. I mean, as you know, we have a dilemma now, and you need low interest rates to stimulate the economy. If we raise interest rates right now, I don't think that would have a very constructive impact on our economy. I suspect Jim agrees with me. I mean, in that sense, I'm a Keynesian. It's also interesting, it's not going to make me feel any better, but that around the world, there's actually very little correlation between how much people save and what the interest rates are. That interest rates are actually quite good here in the 1990s, and nobody saved. In Japan, the bubble burst there around the early 90s, interest rates went to zero. People kept saving like crazy. And now interest rates are zero here. And while Americans are not fantastic savers, as I said, we're saving more than we did when interest rates were high. So, why is this? Well, I think you know why it is. Any saver knows why it is. Where else are you going to put your money? You could put it in more into your home. But home values have, bounced around, and generally they've been gone down since 2008. Maybe they're going up right now, but it's been uncertain. So you can actually lose money by putting money into your home. Jim just said that a few minutes ago. You can put it into the stock market. The future of the stock market is very uncertain. I mean, these platitudes that in the long run are always great with stocks. Ben Bernanke says it. But most people don't have 30 or 40 year horizons, and the next 30 years may not be so great. Who knows? So people have actually saved at no interest rate because it's better to have your principal or maybe a slight diminution for inflation than to have it go down 30% in a house or 20% in the stock market. You don't know. It's not going to make you feel any better, but that's why people often save even when interest rates are very low.
Okay, as we close out, I want to just ask each of you this question. Shell is hard at work at his desk. You're kicking back with him another bottle of wine. Screw work.
How do I know this is not?
Write it in your book.
And the phone rings, and it's President Obama. And he says, please get on the next train to Washington, because you and me and the top leaders in Congress are going to sit and discuss how to get out of this mess we're in. And you are going to be our principal advisor. And while you're on the train, or bicycling up, or whatever it is, I want you to give me, please don't speak in academic, speak in simple,
yeah,
politician type sentences. Give me three or four, however many you want, under 10, things that we should do now to make things better. Give me an agenda.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Okay, the first thing is raise architectures on corporations, and that's beginning towards a transfer of income away from capital towards labor. That is, by the way, not some radical idea. We have been transferring income away from consumption towards saving investment, away from labor towards capital, away from us towards corporations. We've been doing this since 1901 with the rate of tax rates. It has ruined the economy. It's time to stop. So we start by raising
capital gains.
Yep. We raise rates on capital gains too. All right, that's a step. That's the first step. Second step is let's do what John Kerry proposed about 18 months ago. Let's build ourselves an infrastructure bank. Let's do what Americans are really good at, and that is combining, mixing private enterprise and public enterprise. Let's have national grants for infrastructure building, because we really, really need it. And this is a way of maybe surreptitiously socializing the transportation system in a way where we make it upgrade them more energy efficient and upgrade them more efficient in heaven or whatever. Could be, the next step would be to say, all right, what does government standing actually do? Let's actually look at the national term product cost and say, what is it doing? What is it for? Infrastructure aside, how does it work? If households are in fact spending 20%, if 20% of income of all households in the United States comes from government transfer payments, let's now talk about what government does. How does government create jobs? How does government drive employment? As of 1980, you might want to know, about 33% of the labor force was employed either directly or indirectly by government, state, local, and federal. Under George W. Bush, by the way, the second Bush, that the federal direct employment figure rose from 19.2% of the total labor force. Okay? So one out of 35 people in this country is working directly for government. Right? In fact, state and local government was the fastest growing source of employment after 1945. Let's ask them, what can government do better? How do we make taxes actually work? How do we make government spending work? Let's take a look at government spending. Let's treat it as something that diminishes growth, but in fact contributes to it. Because again, if you actually look at the national income product accounts, what you'll find is the largest component of so-called investment is government spending. So that would be the first three steps.
Three or four things.
Yeah.
Okay, Shell.
I would start with a lot of the things that Jim just proposed. I mean, the infrastructure is very important. Gentleman's book talks about surplus capital as the culprit. Well, surplus capital was a problem in the United States, but in places like Germany, a lot of the capital was actually productively invested in infrastructure, and there is a lot we need to do in infrastructure, and this has a great, it's not socialism, it has a great impact on the private sector, on the construction industry, on all sorts of things. And it helps us build a better infrastructure. I mean, if workers can get around cheaply, that adds to labor mobility, that's good for business. If people are better educated, that clearly benefits our society. So there are these clear needs, and I would probably ignore him, he didn't quite complete his sentence, but if I was in charge of job creation, the last thing I would do would be fire public sector workers. This has been, I think, a catastrophe for our current slump. But then I would go further. And I would also think about saving and credit. These may seem obscure to many, but we need to realize that if you are poor, even lower middle class in this country, you don't have the sort of financial access that many of us who are more affluent have. About 25% of lowest income people are unbanked. They have no saving or checking account. They have to go to check cashing services. They get preyed upon by payday lenders. And it's even a higher percentage when you look at the underbanked. In other words, people are being fleeced by high minimum balances, overdraft fees, and lots of things that have turned out to be quite predatory. So we need to come up with better institutions for financial access, not just for saving, but for reasonable forms of credit, because lower income and middle income people need credit. They can't get it for free, obviously, but they don't have to get it for the predatory rates that have happened because they have had so little financial access. We are starting to move tentatively, not fast enough, on the regulation of consumer finance. We have a new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It's actually quite impressive. A lot of people on Wall Street don't like it. That to me is actually meaningful. That means it must be doing something. But clearly, we need to advance affordable types of credit, but we really, really need to curb predatory lending. This is a huge problem in our society. So these were the things I would do in addition to stimulating infrastructure and the general stimulation of the economy.
Well, thank you both. Much appreciated.